Start off by saying, yes, that. If you could, somebody could hit that, that'd be great. I want to start off by saying thank you for having me here. Domio having a much needed vacation in the Midwest, probably getting a whole lot more snow than we're getting here in Portland, at least. I needed somebody to take over. And I know you guys are studying Suzuki Roshi's Zen Mind, beginner mind. I'll make a little allusion to him in this talk, but I didn't want to try to actually speak solely on that because I know you have a set curriculum that you're going through and everything. So she made space for this in that curriculum. So you'll pick right back up where you left off next week, I'm sure, with I think you're right, chapter 4 is next, I think, is it something like that, or 5? I don't know. I'm a Sunday guy. I don't know all these Tuesday things, man, you know. But I want to thank you because, you know, anytime I come to the Zendo, whether it's dirt or cloud, it's great to see everybody practicing. You know, it's just great to see people who have made a choice to do something different and something better than what most people choose to do with their lives, you know, and just staying mired in dukkha. You know, not to say we don't have it too, of course we do, but we're working on it, right? We're sitting here you know, opening the hand of thought and trying to, you know, help bring a better way of being for ourselves and for others. And I think it's that last particular bit where we're here to help serve others that is going to be the main focus of what I talk about tonight. I realize some of you may not know who I am, so I'll just quickly say there's some unfamiliar faces to me here, but I've been with Brightway about 3 years or something now. Doing a bunch of stuff, all the Zoom equipment, all the equipment that we had to put together and figure out how to make work for a cloud Zendo to even exist was on my plate to handle a year and a half, 2 years ago, however long it was. And I'm glad to see that it's thriving and surviving. So we're constantly making improvements. In my private life, I'm a musician, and also I've been in adult education for about 25 plus years. So those two facts will work their way into my discussion tonight in one way or another. So I'm going to do something that I'm not used to tonight, and that's I'm actually going to stick to my notes. Like, I'm looking down at my iPad, which this is crazy. Like, I don't do this. I was telling the guys earlier, I'm a jazz musician, man. I get a couple of brief ideas and I riff on them for some ungodly amount of time. Like, that's my MO. And so to sit here and try to actually look at notes is not my norm. So I'm going to pretend I'm a classical musician. I'm going to read the part, read the page, because I don't want to, I end up riffing on, getting off on a tangent, and then I forget to say something I wanted to say, and then it all comes crashing and burning. No, that's probably not true, but I definitely want to make sure that I get everything out tonight. So I will be referring to my notes. So if you see me looking up at you guys in the camera more than I should, then just go do this. Notes, buddy. Get back to the part. So I, like all of you, I'm really interested in that intersection between practice and regular life, whatever that means, right? How do we use the practice to interact and respond skillfully and compassionately with others, right? It's that with others that is the real focus of what I'm going to talk about tonight. And I think it's one of the main focuses of the practice. Like, what else do we do it if we're not doing it for others? Sitting on a cushion in the Zendo doing Zazen is great, getting all this, you know, peace and equanimity and all this cool stuff. But unless that action helps us to go out into the real world, unless it's prep work for us to go out into the real world and manifest those teachings in our interactions with others, then it's kind of pointless. As Dogen says in Genjo Koan, all things coming and carrying out practice enlightenment through the self is realization. You can't let the myriad things manifest through the self if you don't open yourself up to them to begin with, right? And so that opening ourselves to encompass the myriad things, to become a part of them, so that they can carry out that practice enlightenment through ourselves, is extremely important, and what I want to talk about tonight. You know, we can achieve calm and spaciousness, maybe. I know for some, Zazen's a real struggle. For others, it's very, finally, I get a break. This is awesome, you know. But, you know, getting that calm and spaciousness and connection during Zazen is fabulous, but What about when we're not on the cushion, when we're out in the real world of bills and traffic and laundry and grumpy cashiers at the grocery store and all those things? So one story that I really enjoy on this very topic of sitting on the cushion and looking inward versus bringing the practice to bear outward, there's a great story that's told by the very well-known Buddhist monk Ajahn Sumedho, who comes from the Thai forest tradition of Ajahn Chah. He's currently the head of the Western Order of monastics in that Thai forest tradition. And in his book, Chittavivekā, Teachings from a Silent Mind, he tells a story about his early days. And I'm going to go ahead and read the passage, quote the passage here. So, quote, this is Ajahn Sumedho talking, clarify. Quote, I spent my first year as a Samanera, which in the Thai forest tradition, that's a kind of a novice. It's the equivalent to a novice. I spent my first year as a Samanera living in a monastery in northeast Thailand. I was not compelled to do anything other than just live in a little hut. The monks brought me food every day, and as I could not speak Thai and nobody spoke any English, I didn't have to talk to anyone. The senses were not stimulated to any great extent, so sensory deprivation set in, and I found myself becoming very tranquil, so tranquil, in fact, that I attained great states of bliss and ecstasy. I'd sit on the porch of my little kuti, which is a little hut, and tears of love would well up in my eyes for the mosquitoes that were biting me. I could think in abstract terms about all beings everywhere and feel great love for them too. I even forgave my enemies and those who had caused me suffering in the past. I could entertain these high-minded feelings for all beings, mainly because I was not having to live with them. Then one day I had to go to the immigration authorities to renew my visa. I had to travel to a place called Nong Khai, which is when you cross the Mekong River to get to Laos. Because of my new sensitive state, as I walked to town, I could see things more clearly than ever before. I saw the sorrow and anguish in the faces of the people. And then, when I walked into the immigration office, I felt this iron curtain of hatred forming in front of me. I found out later that the leading monk of the province had ordered the officials to give me a visa. This was not quite in line with regulations, so it had to be, and so it had forced the officials into a position that was really quite unfair. Because of this, they had a definite aversion towards me and would not grant me a visa, which was very confusing for me because of my heightened state of awareness. The feeling of great love I had for all beings began to fade away very quickly. By the time I got back to the monastery, I was in a frantic mental state. I went to my kuti and spent the next 3 days just calming down all that had been aroused during that hour's visit to immigration. So it's great to sit for hours and hours and achieve these great states of bliss, but then when you get out in the real world and it gets put to the test, then all bets are off, right? So this outward practice that I'm referring to, where we're bringing these practice concepts to bear, basically comes down to our state of awareness. Are we paying attention? Are we reading the room, so to speak? Basic textbook mindfulness, if you will. Being able to assess what is needed at any given moment and responding accordingly. This is where our practice is really tested and where we have the opportunity to exercise our bodhisattva vows. To illustrate the importance of this, here's a famous anecdote. This is a famous story, but I'm going to read it out of Philip Kaplow Roshi's Three Pillars of Zen. So it's on page 11 for those of you who have this book. One day, a man of the people said to Zen Master Ikkyu, "Master, will you please write for me some maxims of the highest wisdom?" Ikkyu immediately took his brush and wrote the word "attention." "Is that all?" asked the man. "Will you not add something more?" Ikkyu then wrote twice, running, "Attention, attention." "Well," remarked the man rather irritably, "I really don't see much depth or subtlety in what you have just written." Then Ikkyu wrote the same word three times running, "Attention, attention, attention." Half angered, the man demanded, "What does that word attention mean anyway?" And Ikkyu answered gently, "Attention means attention." This is Kaplow Roshi's commentary on that. For the ordinary man or woman whose mind is a checkerboard of crisscrossing reflections, opinions, and prejudices, bare attention is virtually impossible. One's life is thus centered not in reality itself, but in one's ideas of it. By focusing the mind wholly on each object and every action, Zazen strips it of extraneous thoughts and allows us to enter into a full rapport with life. Sitting Zazen and mobile Zazen are two functions equally dynamic and mutually reinforcing. I like that image of sitting Zazen versus mobile Zazen. Maybe we should just call it that. Just mobile Zazen. I'm doing mobile Zazen now. How our practicing the practice on the cushion can strengthen the muscles of compassion and equanimity that we can then go out into the world and flex in that Saha world of laundry, traffic bills, and grumpy people. This is what the Buddha was referring to when Ananda said, "Truly, blessed one, Sangha is half the practice." And the Buddha said, no, Ananda, don't say that. Sangha is the whole of the practice. He was referring to the fact that paying attention to our lives, engaging with others, is the surest way to live the Dharma. So what is this attention that Ikkyu was referring to, and how can we put it into practice in the real world? Well, being in adult education for 25 plus years, I have developed a four-step process. It's not really my invention, of course. Nothing is. Nothing's original. Everything's just a remix, you know, to use a musical term. But cobbled together this list. And like I've stated in previous talks, I love a good mnemonic device, something that's easy to remember, a little catchy, little catchphrase. So I call this the four A's. Four A's, as in the letter A. And they are awareness, assessment, adaptation, and action. Let me describe what those each are. So awareness or attention first. In any given situation, so this is a stepwise process too, one following the next. So I'm sitting in a room, I'm sitting on the light rail, the Max train, for instance, right? Or I'm in a restaurant, or I'm in the grocery store. I'm somewhere normal. First thing I need to do is become aware of and pay attention to my surroundings, letting all five senses with the mind as the sixth sense open up to what's happening. Both things that are really obvious, but also things that may be hidden under the surface, where I'm kind of relying more on gut instinct or intuition. Obviously, this requires that I'm not all up inside my own head and daydreaming or pondering. It also requires that I'm not completely absorbed in something totally ridiculous, like doom scrolling Facebook on my iPhone or something, right? I've got to be up and listening and looking and cognizing what's happening around me. So that's step one. Step two is assessment. So then, based on what I'm observing in that space, what's the feeling tone? How do people feel? What's happening? Are there conversations happening? Do people look happy or sad? You know, it's all a guess, of course. Like, you don't really know what's going on in their minds, but at least you're making an effort to get under the surface a little more. And believe me, it often doesn't really matter if you have assessed it correctly or not, because it's more about the action of opening up than it is what you do with that information sometimes. So we open up to the thinking. I already got off my notes. Based on how the situation is unfolding, then where do I think it's going to go next? And just be with that. Just being present with reality as it is actually happening before my eyes. Now, this is what Kaplan Roshi was saying. Well, that, you know, bare attention where I can observe all of this and have no ideas or opinions about it, that's nearly impossible because we're conditioned beings, right? Everything that I'm observing is coming through my own specific conditioning, my likes and dislikes, my opinions, my prejudices, my biases, all that type of thing. So, but to the degree that I can try to pull it back, at least a little bit, and be with reality as it actually is. This is what in Zen we call bearing witness, which you hear a lot in terms of people passing away, you know, being there at the time of death. But we can bear witness in the grocery store. We can bear witness on the highway, too. Just being with things as they are. So then once I have made an assessment, I've opened my awareness, I've said, well, things seem to be like this or like that, and this person's grumpy, this person's happy, and this seems to be a kind of a heated conversation going on between those two individuals. As I've made that assessment as to where things kind of are and I'm just with it, now my third step is to adapt. Adaptation. Flexing as necessary to meet the situation while trying to maintain my balance and equanimity. This is where the adaptation means that I have to set my ego aside. I have to set my preferences aside. I have to set my fears aside. Unless it's, you know, there's actually a violent situation unfolding, in which case, you know, let the amygdala do its work and run, you know, or get the heck out of the way of the person with a knife or whatever, you know. But in most everyday situations, I have to set those things aside and just try to be present for that situation as it is and move forward into that new space that's opening up before me, even though it may be marked by uncertainty. And I'll talk a little bit more about this moving into the uncertainty later. So this is going to require all that compassion and selflessness and all that that we've cultivated on the cushion, hopefully, right? Or we have at least faced on the cushion. Being able to put away our fears, egos, and agendas. In the second part of the book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which I don't think you guys are getting to I think you're just focusing on the first part. Doesn't matter. Anyway, in the second part of the book, there's a chapter called Constancy, which is a funny word, I think. I don't know that that's an actual word, but Suzuki Roshi was known for inventing his own English words that made more sense than the actual English words did, I think. Suzuki Roshi refers to this process of moving forward through all things with strength and resilience and being steadfast despite the turbulence of the situation. He says, quote, "Constancy means constant faculty or ability or possibility to accept things. There is no particular effort involved, but only the constant ability or faculty which we have to accept." I like to equate this to out of in the six paramitas, the third paramita, which is patient forbearance, right? The ability to just be patient and deal with what's unfolding before us without trying to make it different, without running away from it necessarily, unless it needs to be run away from. But a lot of when we start inserting ourselves in, I don't like this, and I think that person should be acting like this, and this is wrong, and all that type of thing. All we're really doing there is trying to mollify the small mind. We're not really opening ourselves to that experience and adjusting to meet it where it actually is. So then the fourth step, the final step, is action. I decide to either act or not based on the observed need. Sometimes a helping hand is all that's needed, or an understanding smile. Maybe I need to move out of the way entirely. You know, maybe there's an awkward situation unfolding and it's best if I'm just not there for their sake, not for my own. Right? Maybe the people involved in the situation are like, there's some strange weirdo behind me and I need to actually exit stage left, you know, so to speak. But sometimes I may need to deliberately insert myself into the situation in some type of a skillful, compassionate way. And other times, any kind of direct intervention could actually make the situation worse. So sometimes it's best to just stay silent and extend loving kindness to all those involved if necessary. There's another story that I really like, and it comes from this book called The Art of Possibility. This is by Benjamin Zander and Rosamund Stone Zander. This is not a Dharma book, but there's a lot in here that actually crosses over some Dharmic themes. I got this book many, many years ago. It's one of those books that I'm like on my fifth copy of, because I buy it and then I give it to somebody. You know, I'll probably do it tonight. Here, take this, because it's, you know, and then I'm going to have to go and buy another copy. But it's full of a lot of really good stuff. It's kind of a self-help book. The subtitle is Transforming Professional and Personal Life. But it's got some really, really, really excellent stuff in it. So Benjamin Zander is a conductor of orchestras. He was Boston Philharmonic, Boston Youth Symphony. So I like a lot of his music-related stories, and this is going to be one of them too. But his wife, Rosamund Stone Zander, is a psychotherapist. So they kind of mix these, you know, things that he's experienced and she's experienced into like, and here's a great way to deal with your life. So it's a cool book. I highly recommend getting it. All right, so here's the story. The legendary Kolisch Quartet had the singular distinction of playing its entire repertoire from memory, including the impossibly complex works of Arnold Schoenberg, Weber, and Bartok and Berg, if you're not into really crazy sounding esoteric 20th century classical music, then those names may mean nothing to you, but those guys wrote some really wild stuff. I'll put it that way. Eugene Lehner was the violist, so a viola type of a string instrument. Eugene Lehner was the violist for the quartet in the 1930s. Laner's stories about their remarkable performances often included hair-raising moments when one player or another had a memory slip. In the middle of the slow movement of Beethoven's String Quartet Opus 95, just before his big solo, Laner suddenly had an inexplicable memory lapse in a place where his memory had never failed him before. He literally blacked out. But the audience heard Opus 95 as it was meant to be played, the viola solo sounding in all its richness. Even the first violinist, Rudolf Kolisch, and the cellist, Benner Heifetz, both with their eyes closed and deeply absorbed in the music, were unaware that Laner had dropped out. The second violinist, Felix Kuhner, was playing Laner's melody, coming in without missing a beat at the viola's designated entrance, the notes perfectly in tune and voiced like a viola on an instrument tuned a fifth higher. Laner was stunned and offstage after the performance asked Kuhner how could he have possibly known to play his part. Kuhner answered with a shrug, "I could see your finger was poised over the wrong string, so I knew you must have forgotten what came next." Now, for those of you not familiar with how stringed instruments work or string quartets work, this is an absolutely amazing situation because in the span of two seconds, maybe three at the most. So you've got a string quartet, four people sitting like this, and the second violinist is here and the violist is right here to his right. So the first thing that Kuhner had to do in this like 2 to 3 seconds was be aware. So the first day, right, he had to be observing what was happening around him and not just kind of in his own, up in his head and thinking about the next part he had to play. He was observing and he noticed the viola player, Kuhner, or Laner. I get these German names mixed up. Laner is sitting there and he noticed his finger was over the wrong string. Now that's a level of perception that I don't think most people have, right? And so he notices that, and that in and of itself is amazing. But then so the second thing he does is he makes an assessment, the second A. And he makes the assessment that Laner has forgotten the part. Now that's an audacious assumption to make. Just because the guy's finger is over the wrong string, you think he's completely forgotten what to play? Like that's a bit over the top. Then, based on that assessment, his finger is over the wrong string and he has forgotten his part. He's got a big solo coming up and he's completely forgotten it. He then had to adapt, adaptation, the third A, and decided to play Laner's part on his behalf. His finger's over the wrong string. He's totally forgotten his part. I will play it instead. Okay. Then he acts. He calls to mind the solo and he plays it expertly, even though he has never been asked to play that solo. That's not his part. That's the other guy's part, right? And even more amazing from a musician's standpoint is his violin has a completely, the strings are in a different order, everything is different than the viola, even though they look identical. It's very different. The fingers are in a totally different place. So not only did he have to know the solo, but then he had to play it down on the lower strings where the viola would be sounding and come in at the right time. So it's completely amazing that he had that level of perception and just sprung to action. So he went through the four A's in that context in about 2 seconds. Said, "Oh, okay, here we go," woo, and started playing. Amazing. And he was also kind of breaking the rules, if you will, of string quartet performance because there's no real written rule. You know, they don't sit around and say, "Hey, if I forget my part, would you play it for me? You know, here's how it goes." And, you know, that's not how it works, right? So totally audacious thing to do. And you want to talk about just going right to the brink of what he knows should happen and what he's comfortable with and what usually happens. And this is that stepping forward into that uncertainty. Being willing to just accept, as Suzuki Roshi says, just accept what's happening and do something about it. And take action. So, how many of us, though, in our daily lives are reticent to practice these four A's, even if we didn't know what they were? How many of us are reticent to, even if we open up our awareness? How many of us are willing to, when we make that assessment, not let the ego mind take over, not let our preferences take over, let alone moving forward into adapting to that, flexing to match it, and even more audacious to step forward and try to do something about it and step forward into action. A lot of us probably have the mindset like, yeah, something's wrong here, but it's maybe there's a reason for it. It's not my job to fix it. You know, if I try to fix it, I could be wrong and then I'll look like the idiot. You know, they'll get mad at me. You know, I could actually suffer some harm here, perhaps. So rather than stepping in and taking on the burden of helping, taking on the burden of a situation that's unfolding before us, setting aside our ego and our agenda and helping, then we just push the problem right back onto whoever is dealing with it in that moment. And I think we all know, as I said at the beginning, like I love being as a song guy. Everybody's practicing and trying to, you know, be better than most people, you know, want to be, right? Just to look at life in a different way and be more helpful. And that's why we take that Bodhisattva vow, right? We try to, you know, those of us who have really committed to that. I had the Bodhisattva vow tattooed on my forearms, for God's sake. Like, you want to take it seriously, right? That just committing to that act of stepping forward and helping where it's necessary in a skillful and compassionate way. Sometimes maybe our willingness to go further than simply observing, that requirement to flex, that requirement to adapt and then to act, maybe it's conditional, right? Maybe we're more than happy to extend that to some people, but not to others. Maybe I'm happy to do it with my family, and maybe I can do it very naturally with my family, right? I've got a 13-year-old and a almost 6-year-old. And so with them, it's like that, right? It's from I'm more attentive than I would be with a lot of other people, and I see something happen, and I'm like, boom, and I'm just on it, and I'm acting, right? Because they're my kids, right? But could I extend that to somebody on the highway? Can I extend that to somebody in the grocery store who might need something from me? How many times have we heard that story about somebody on a busy city sidewalk, obviously in distress, laying on the sidewalk, and people just walk on by? They just keep chugging, not my problem, right? Maybe their awareness is there and they've made an assessment. That's all they're willing to do. They're not willing to adapt at all. I'm late for an appointment, I gotta go. I couldn't help them anyway. Why should I help them? They can't even help themselves, right? All these little stories that pop up in those situations. Would we be less likely to walk down the city street and if we see somebody laying on the ground and he's 20 years old, 6 foot tall guy with a big green mohawk and leather jacket and studs sticking out of it, a bunch of tattoos and all that. Would we be less willing to help him than if it was a little old lady? To look like your grandma laying on the ground. Yeah. And that, depending on where we've been, what we've seen, maybe we would be more likely to help that guy. The person who is brave enough and kind enough to stop and help all beings. That's what the vow says right here, right about there on my arms. All sentient beings. It doesn't say, well, only the ones who deserve it. You know, only the ones who look like they really need the help. They could have taken care of it, but they didn't, you know, and something's happened and they're an innocent victim. You know? Not like those other people who have it coming. The one who's kind enough, brave enough to stop and help is the Bodhisattva, showing that immense courage and compassion. And that's really what it comes down to. It's courage, bravery. It takes courage to see something, figure out what's happening, and then adapt and flex and move into that space and then try to do something about it. Even if it's just a little, hey, are you okay? Like, that's enough. That's Bodhisattva action. You don't have to like save their life or, you know, buy them a meal. And although that's great if you can and do it. But it sometimes it's just that little bit of kindness and compassion that makes all the difference We have to be willing to set aside our own agenda, ego, expectations, and just meet the situation where it is for what it is, with no hesitation. This is what that violinist Kuhner did, right? He just set aside his own sense of self, what he was supposed to be doing, how he thought the performance was supposed to be going, his fears about what might happen. I mean, he could have been wrong, right? Oh, his finger's over the wrong string. He must have forgotten the part. I'm going to play it for him. And then they both come in. And now he's the jerk, you know? He's messed up the performance. Like, oh, this isn't a duet. Okay, you know, how am I going to cover my butt on that one, right? Even though he probably had some little fear about it, he simply responded from a place of compassion and camaraderie. But peeling back the layers of delusion to get to that point, to get to that pure awareness and energy can be really hard, right? I mean, that's what we're here for, right? Even when we sit, we feel calm and we're open, we're undistracted, and we're sensitive to our surroundings, reading the room and all that. It's really typical for small mind to just jump in and start evaluating and judging and clinging. What's in it for me? And if I do something, will it blow up on my face? And all that type of thing. When Dogen says taking the backward step and turning the light around to illuminate the self, I had one perception of this for a long time. I thought, okay, you're taking the backward step away from your small self and you're turning the light around and you're shining it on yourself. Oh, look at all these bad parts here. Oh, this is, yeah, that's unskillful. That's unskillful. This is okay, you know. But now I've come to realize, like, no, that's actually, I mean, that's probably part of it too. But I like to think of it as taking that backward step and turning that light around for my ego, my agenda, my likes and dislikes, instead shining it out to the room, to the town, to the state, to the country, to the universe around me, and say, what do you need? What do these people need? What do they like and don't like? Where are they? Are they happy? Are they suffering? Are they somewhere in between? And by shining that light outward, we can bring that broad awareness. We get out of our little storage closet of small mind and into this vast, unencumbered space of awareness, shining a light on the boundless, absolute self. All these great words that we read. But when we get caught up in that, what's in it for me, we're just turning that light right back around on our ego and agenda. That door of awareness closes and we just stepped right back into our little box. So, even if we muster our courage and end up failing, right? Because isn't that our big fear? Well, I could probably do something here, but what? It's kind of weird. I don't know. I could screw it up. Like, they may not appreciate it. They may actually, you know, turn on me or something. I'm not gonna, right? If we do that, we're fearing the failure. Right? I step into the situation and I screw it up. Now I'm going to feel bad. Nomio has alluded to this many times in her talks, that the quality of the outcome isn't the point. It's the quality of the effort that is the point. Now she said that in relation to Zazen itself. Right? Like if you're sitting and you're feeling like, I'm not getting anywhere and I'm not achieving calm states of equanimity, and like that's not really the point. How solid is your intention? When you go to sit, how much you're like, I am going to sit. One of my favorite quotes by Norman Zoketsu Fisher is, sit until the bell rings or you drop dead, whichever comes first. But I think that quality of the outcome isn't the point. It's the quality of the effort, the quality of the intention that's the point. Applies to everything we do in life. Success and failure are just constructs of the thinking mind anyway. The mind of discrimination and difference. And his, I'm not going to like read it out, but I love this book. And there's a talk in here called Effort and Non-Effort that I love. I had a whole bunch of little sticky tabs on that I had to take off because they were getting in the way. But in the chapter Effort and Non-Effort, Kjelgen Carlson says, the quality of effort is about changing from a mindset of grasping at good results to one of dropping our resistance to failure. Getting rid of grasping at good results don't even try. That's pretty hard, right? To like, I don't care if I succeed. Like there's almost an apathy to that we don't want to step into that place, right? But I can let go of my fear of failure. That's a lot easier, right? And as I know, for me personally as a musician, like, you know, or with anything, like any activity or hobby you do, how many you fail 57 times and you succeed once, right? And it's that ability to let go of a fear of failure and to fail and to drop and get back up and do it again. That's really the key. And so if we can drop that fear of failure, when we get to that, you know, we do our awareness, we make our assessment, but then we get to that point of adaptation and then action. If we can drop that fear of failure, we might be able to move into that space more skillfully and more successfully and with more courage and more strength and more bravery. Like, yes, I can do this. Yeah, on that topic, I'm sorry, I'm editing. Another quick story. I've told this story before because I just love it. And this one's Ajahn Sumedho again, interestingly enough. So Ajahn Chah, the great Thai forest master, had Ajahn Sumedho as a disciple, and Ajahn Sumedho had become a very senior disciple taking over parts of the monastery. Ajahn Chah said to Sumedho, go to England and found a monastery in England. This was pretty audacious. This is like the late 60s, early 70s. Yeah, I think it was early 70s. So Sumedho does this because you did what Ajahn Chah told you to do, basically, right? So he goes to England and he founds this Chithurst Monastery in rural England. And a couple years later, he comes back to Thailand and meets with Ajahn Chah. And Ajahn Chah says, how's the new monastery? And Ajahn Sumedho said, oh, it's great. Everybody's getting along. We got plenty of food. I got the work practice. Everything is just really wonderful. Everybody is just really taking it seriously and enjoying it and da-da-da-da-da. It's just all these wonderful accolades. And you would have expected Ajahn Chah to say, hey, that's great. I'm really glad. But what Ajahn Chah said instead was, you're never going to learn anything that way. Like, he was almost upset to hear that things were going so well because he knew that it's that bumping up against difficulty, that bumping up against failure, that's really where the lessons are learned. We think back to our second violinist. He obviously had cultivated enough awareness to sense what was about to happen, enough bravery to take decisive action to respond, and enough willingness to fail that he broke with expected behaviors. He took the chance that he could have been wrong and screw up the whole performance, and he went right forward into that uncharted territory anyway. He also had enough sense of self to respond, not so much that he sought to be the hero who saved the concert, wanting to receive accolades. He wasn't thinking, oh, I'm going to come in and play the solo and everybody's going to love me because I saved the show. You know, he wasn't thinking that at all. He was just like, this is what needs to be done. He kept his awareness open, observed the need, mustered his courage, and did the next thing that needed doing. This is a favorite teaching of mine from a local Zen teacher in the Rinzai tradition, Rinzan Pachovnik Osho at No Rank Zendo. He constantly says, I think probably every single talk he ever gives, he says, just do the next thing that needs doing. And the next thing, and the next thing. It takes courage. It takes that ability to set aside the ego and just move forward into the situation, bringing that bodhisattva action to bear to help sentient beings. Thank you. I'll open it up for questions or comments or criticisms. So in the cloud Zendo, if you want to raise your virtual or physical hand, I see Jinryu choosing the latter there. Jinryu, go ahead, please.
Thank you, James. That was really wonderful. I expected it to be wonderful. You're always very good.
I was one of you.
I know. This thing about being alert, this first A, you know, that's easier said than done, right? I mean, because it takes a tremendous amount of energy. That's the best way I can describe it, because my habit is to be thinking about me and what I'm doing and where I'm going. And this guy collapsed on the sidewalk and I, whatever. And so I just wanted to throw that out there I guess maybe because it makes me feel better. But I do, I go for that awareness every single day, alert and aware, and I lose it in less than an hour. And then I try again. But anyway, it was a very good talk.
Thank you. Yeah, I think there's a degree to which you could almost make it four A's with a loop. Because I think in a way, to open up attention, to get to the first A, you kind of have to skip to the third A, adaptation, right? You have to like start from this place of openness and setting aside ego and setting aside agenda and setting aside preferences before you can even open yourself up to that level of awareness. I mean, depending on the situation, right? And I think that's like that kind of hidden first A of adaptation before the attention can really be given. That's, for me, I think that's a lot of what the practice is, like actual Dharma practice, like sitting in the Zendo, sitting on the cushion, Dharma study, chanting, like all those activities are, you know, as I said in a talk a couple of years ago, I was like, it's practicing the practice, like I'm practicing how to open myself up, right? And so that setting aside ego and trying to expand my awareness and consciousness helps me then go out into the real world and be attentive and set and just sit back and observe. That helps. Thank you. Linda.
Thank you, James. That was very engaging and insightful, and I feel like you got a lot of content in a reasonable amount of time. It was very good. So I was thinking as you were talking and reflecting back now on the notes I took, and I would say that sometimes there are situations where this process is applied to or can be applied to situations externally from us. So I tend to be a person who's always on alert. If I see like a dog who's not on a leash and is out by themselves, or in a store, a small child like getting ready to cry because I don't know where their mommy is, I'm a magnet for those kind of situations where I want to help, you know, connect the kid with the parent, connect the dog with the owner, stuff like that. But then on the other hand, I started contemplating on a situation in a friendship I have where by being aware and kind of stepping aside a little bit, I see where maybe certain parts of that friendship aren't maybe serving me well. You know, so it's easy for me to reach out and maybe act to help someone else, but there can be situations where maybe I need to act to say, hey, maybe this isn't such a good aspect of this relationship. But for me, bringing up anything like that is very uncomfortable. Because I think sometimes, like you were saying, being alert and selfless for other people, but then how do we apply that towards ourselves when maybe the situation could use some help or something that would be better? Better for us, which also might help the other person in other situations. You know, if a certain aspect of the personality or maybe taking their unhappiness or frustrations out by being critical. That's what I'm thinking of. Whereas that might not be good for me, but it also might not be good for other people, but that person you know, that person could maybe learn something is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But that it's hard for me to do that. So I guess I would be interested in knowing if anyone or you have some insight up in terms of how to apply to the compassion to ourselves by taking action on something.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I think, you know, I spoke about this stuff in somewhat linear terms, mm-hmm. but it's all cyclical.
Mm-hmm.
Like there has to be a degree where you're applying, like you said, you're applying these to yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what our, you know, we sit zazen or we're in a contemplation of some form and you're, you know, opening up my awareness to myself, you know, and what's happening, what am I feeling? And can I set small mind aside so that I can actually address that? And, you know, so all of these four A's that I we're talking about tonight can certainly be turned right back around on ourselves. And I think doing so then enables us to go out and practice them on others. And, you know, because, I mean, it's like anything else, right? They call it the practice because I'm actually practicing, you know, like how to, like I'm a trumpet player, right? So I sit in my room and I do, bah, 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 bah. Oh, that sucked. Okay, let me try that again. And because if I don't do that, then I can't go to the concert and play the part, right? I'm going to just completely blow it, you know? I don't know how to play the clarinet, you know? And I'm not going to go like up to a symphony orchestra and grab a clarinet and sit down at a concert and say, I can do this, you know, because I haven't practiced, right? So in order to put out skillful action, I think there is a large degree to which we have to turn that inward. We have to bring that back before we can then push that out to others. And then when we push it out to others, when we extend that compassion and that skillful action out to others, then that, I think it sounded like you made the point that then that can inspire them to, you know, turn that back around, and then it can become just this cyclical thing, right? Where we're in emotional intelligence world, we call that the fourth stage of relationship management, where if I'm acting skillfully, that inspires you to act skillfully, and then we're both going to benefit, and then everybody else is going to benefit, and it just kind of blossoms out in all directions. So hopefully I interpreted your comment correctly. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sando, anyone? Erica, hi. Yeah, coming up. I don't think I got the chair in the right position for the camera, but the microphone.
Oh,
is good. Yeah.
There you go. I used to live in New York City, and I had a job in Manhattan, and there was a day where I went out on my lunch break, and I was crossing a one-way street. So, you know, I was only looking at the traffic going on the one-way street. I didn't look the other direction, which was not a good idea, but so I didn't see anything, and I started walking across the street, and I didn't see anything. I just felt my legs getting caught in someone's bicycle wheels. Somebody had hit me straight on with their bike, and I fell backwards. I caught myself, you know, on the sidewalk, but then my hands were like bleeding, covered in gravel. And I was like lying on the sidewalk, and nobody stopped and helped me. Nobody. There were some people that like kind of stopped and stared at me, but nobody asked me if I was okay. Nobody did anything. The guy on the bike like ran off, and I just, you know, there, it was physically painful, but what was so much worse was that nobody asked if I was okay.
Yeah.
You know, and so it was honestly shocking to me, and it still kind of is, but mm-hmm. I thought of that when you were talking about just the importance of not just being aware, because obviously anybody who saw that would be aware, but just mm-hmm. knowing when to take some action.
Yeah.
You know, and that it really only takes a second. You know, it would have made such a difference to me if somebody just asked, are you okay?
Yeah.
You know, which takes 1 second.
Yeah.
So,
wow.
Anyway.
Well, thanks for sharing. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's Yeah, and I kind of thought, you know, when I was having the mental image when I wrote that piece in the, I picture like New York City, right? Yeah. And I think there's that, like that prejudice, like, New Yorkers are just a bunch of jerks. They don't care about anybody. But I think there's a deeper reason for it too, right? There's a deeper meaning behind, well, why is it that the majority of a population of a specific or any metropolitan area that, you know, why is it that maybe that reaction has cultivated, has become the norm? Whereas if, I'll bet you anything, if you were in a different part of the country and that same event happened, you'd have five people like, oh, let me help you up. Let's take her, you know, and like, I've got a first aid kit in my car, and they, you know, and would be helping you out. So what is it about like the communal attitude of a specific place that makes that happen? And I think, you know, it's like, there's a certain mindset in a lot of metropolitan areas, but definitely New York. It's just look out for yourself, hustle and bustle, get it done. You know, don't look left or right, just keep going forward. And that, yeah, that's really unfortunate, right? that would, that's become the norm. So, and that's like I was saying, it's like, that's awareness and awareness and assessment, but then a complete refusal to go any farther than that. So, yeah, thanks for sharing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Looks like we got about 4 minutes left. If anybody else has comment or question. I used to teach, I don't actively teach anymore. Corporate trainer role. 20 years I've been doing that, but my most recent class, we were doing it remote, you know, after COVID. And I would say, any questions? And I would just sit there for the longest time. You know, and they would call me like, man, you really love uncomfortable silences. Like, there's nothing uncomfortable at all about silence. All right, well then, I guess we'll close it down. We dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all, so that they may be able to attain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, James.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank you.
Beauty Queen Wave.
Eric, your story reminded me of something that happened to me in San Francisco.
Thanks, James.